Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 130, I am rejoined by Dr. Steven Christensen, better known as iSteve. We discuss his thoughts on the recent Retina Society meeting, including his summary available on his website of some of the talks. We talk specifically about talks regarding autofluorescence for retinoschisis, wide-field imaging, as well as results of retrospective analyses for phakic and pseudophakic retinal detachment repair. We end by discussing and plugging our upcoming course at the American Academy of Ophthalmology annual meeting. This course will be Monday, October 29th at 4:30 p.m. in room N136. Steve, myself, Drs. Uziwoma Abugo, Rahul Khurana, and Matthew Weed will cover topics on online content creation and consumption by ophthalmologists and why it's important. Please try to stop by and support us. You won't want to miss it. It should be fun and educational. Any questions about the course, please feel free to reach out to Steve or myself directly. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be rejoined by a previous correspondent, Dr. Steven Christensen. Dr. Christensen is a second-year vitreoretinal surgical fellow at the Cincinnati Eye Institute in Cincinnati, Ohio, and is better known as iSteve in online and social media circles. Has his own website, iSteve.com, which offers patient and physician information regarding ophthalmology. Steve, good morning. How are you?
Doing well, Jay. Thanks for having me.
So we're here to talk about a couple things, but we're going to focus a little bit on the recent Retina Society annual meeting, which was in San Francisco, California, the second weekend of September. We're recording this just a few days after. This may post in about a week from now, so maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks after the meeting to let things kind of marinate. Steve, how overall meeting was good? You had a good time? I unfortunately wasn't able to make it this year, but I heard things were, it was a very good meeting.
Yeah, I had a great time. Retina Society is one of these meetings, I'm sure everyone else knows a lot more about it than I did, but it's a fairly prestigious group. It's someone by invitation and application that you become a member. I was just kind of a fly on the wall lurking to learn from everyone, but it's a great meeting to attend as a fellow. It's fairly inexpensive, and it really has great content. That typically, the presentations are created by the fellow and then presented by the attending faculty member, so it's really neat.
And not to get off topic, you mentioned the expense issue. I'm not going to get into specific meetings, but I mean, some meetings can be exorbitantly expensive, especially when you're in training, if you don't have, you know, some sort of support funding, or even your program has a cap on how much you funded. So it is nice that they make it affordable, especially for people in training.
Absolutely. And that's primarily why I was able to go.
You know, like many people who are unable to attend these meetings, I enjoy the benefits of 21st century technology. And I think it would have been interesting maybe 20 or 30 years ago, if you weren't able to go to these meetings, how would you even know what was discussed or what was talked about? I can think throwaway journals kind of filled that niche maybe in the last 15, 20 years. And now in the last few years, we have social media and Twitter. And I was following the meeting on Twitter. You and others were tweeting talks, images, things like that. And that made it helpful to follow the meeting. And then you posted an article on your website, actually, called 2018 Meeting Highlights. And this, in addition to like the Retina Roundup that Yoshi Inokawa and his colleagues have done in terms of summarizing the meeting, was really helpful to kind of keep track of what was discussed and what you found interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the highlights. So this is up on your website, iSteve.com. It's under the subheading Retina Society 2018. I'm going to cherry pick a couple things I found that were interesting. So it's J.P. Hubschman from UCLA. He gave this talk you described about imaging degenerative retinoschisis using wide-field autofluorescence. Tell us a little bit about this, what he described, and why you thought it was clinically important.
Sure. Well, Dr. Hubschman really gave a nice talk where he described using fundus autofluorescence, wide-field autofluorescence, to characterize peripheral lesions as being retinoschisis or primary retinal detachment, detachment of the neurosensory retina. And so in this study, essentially, he had 233 eyes with retinoschisis, and in 38 of these eyes, there was wide-field autofluorescence. 21 of those 38 had hyperautofluorescence, and then 17 did not have hyperautofluorescence. So basically, he was using autofluorescence to try and determine whether autofluorescence could characterize a lesion as being an RD or schisis or a schisis RD. And he found that in 10 out of the 10, around 100% of the eyes that had hyperautofluorescence and that then were confirmed with OCT to have subretinal fluid or confirmation of a neurosensory detachment. On the other hand, the eyes without hyperautofluorescence, none of those eyes had any subretinal fluid. So essentially the key takeaway that I thought to be helpful was, well, really two things, maybe three things. Clinically, we typically can characterize whether a detachment is ascesis or an RD, or maybe sometimes we're curious if it's ascesis detachment. And so that's, I think, where this paper can help us determine that is with imaging. And as we all know, oftentimes we're getting more and more patients sent to us with wide field imaging from a referring provider's office. And if they're able to get a wide field autofluorescence to then determine on their own side whether it's an RD or whether that lesion that they're concerned about is just simply ascesis, then that improves our referral patterns and helps us be taking care of patients with detachments and not necessarily those with ascesis. Now, maybe that's a little bit of a stretch to say that they should be using autofluorescence to make that determination, but it's something to think about, that imaging is getting to that point where we can have some tools that can improve our referral pattern. And then finally, it's neat to be able to see these lesions as being the combination of ascesis and an RD, because those areas with the hyperautofluorescence do show subretinal fluid when it's confirmed with OCT.
Yeah, it's really nice. You know, I think we all learned either in residency or fellowship the whole list of ways to distinguish ascesis and detachment. And there's all these old school kind of ways that weren't imaging tools, such as, you know, the appearance of the dome-shaped kind of smooth appearance versus the corrugations. There's this old thing they used to talk about, if you put a laser, you know, kind of beam, an aiming beam on it, you know, you could prove the relative versus absolute scotoma. But from a practical level, imaging is probably the most useful way to distinguish it, and then that's the modern way. And this is just nice to have another kind of tool to distinguish, especially, like you said, when there's these combined cases, to determine which areas of a combined, you know, case are ascesis versus detachment may also influence your surgical planning. So really nice. You know, another imaging talk you kind of described was Nitin Chowdhury from Canada described wide field imaging. And this can be a little dry for people, but it's interesting to do kind of recommendations about how to characterize different areas of the periphery. So what were kind of your takeaways from his talk?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, Dr. Chowdhury gave a nice talk where he was just suggesting that we standardize some of the terminology with which we use to describe wide field imaging. And so he suggested that we use the fovea as the center of the photo. And this is, like you said, this is pretty dry, and maybe it's below the level of our listeners. But just to review, he suggested we use the fovea as the center, that we describe lesions as being within the posterior pole, which is within the arcades and just slightly beyond, and then the mid-periphery being from the posterior pole or the posterior edge of the posterior, or the anterior edge of the posterior pole out to the vortex vein ampulla. And then the far periphery would be anterior to the vortex veins. And then wide field would be beyond the vortex veins. And then ultra wide field would be in the far periphery. So this is out to all four quadrants. So in other words, he just suggested, I think, as you and I know, when we're talking about wide field imaging, we often say, oh, wide field and ultra wide field. And we just kind of bundle those together as the same term because we don't really know what either means. So that's what was neat about Dr. Chowdhury's talk, is he suggested that we really standardize how we talk about these fundus photos so that we all are on the same page with what we're talking about. And then in addition to that, Jay, what I liked is that he suggested that OCT, we also need to be describing in more detail than we currently are describing. Often when we're teaching residents in imaging conferences, we'll say, they'll just say, this is an OCT of the right eye. And Dr. Chowdhury really suggested we need to be giving more description than that, because now wide field OCT is available. And so OCT is not just there of the macula. It could be out to the equator, and maybe a montage is being used for that OCT. And so he really suggested that we use additional terminology to describe OCT B scans, as well as that ultra wide field and wide field imaging.
You know, changing gears from imaging, we love the surgical stuff, and you described multiple talks about surgery. Let's start with Will Park, who's a frequent correspondent on the show. He gave a talk regarding macular holes concurrent with retinal attachments in the PRO study, which was the primary retinal detachment outcome study, which was kind of a multi-center retrospective study looking at retinal detachment outcomes. We'll talk about other studies within the PRO study. But specifically, the idea of macular holes concurrent with retinal detachments. And I was fascinated by the results you described and that Will had given this talk about. So let's talk a little bit about what they found in terms of hole closure with or without ILM peeling. Because I think this is the thing that would be the biggest take-home point for these cases, where ILM peeling can be challenging in the case, especially of a macula involving detachment, and where maybe there's a macular hole detachment where you're considering not doing a vitrectomy, and now you're thinking about, well, and maybe I have to do a vitrectomy because I need to peel the ILM. So tell us a little bit about what he said.
Sure. So Dr. Park gave this really nice talk discussing, just like you've mentioned, macular holes concurrent with retinal detachments. And the, like you said, the key takeaway really was the hole closure. He found that the closure of the macular hole, the rate, I'm trying to remember exactly the rate, but it was 92% of cases where the ILM was peeled in the setting of a macular hole and an RD, 92% of those cases, the hole closed. And in 95% of the cases where the ILM was not peeled, the hole similarly closed. So I've talked to multiple colleagues and attendings, and about half peel the ILM and half don't peel the ILM. And well, maybe it really doesn't matter because 84% of these cases ended up having a single surgery repair of the retinal detachment. And then I'm finding it now, there was 93% success rate of the macular hole closure.
Right, which is interesting. You know, I remember having this discussion as a fellow, and I think that, again, if you can peel the ILM in these cases, and I've done it. I've done actually probably a decent number of these concurrent macular hole cases. But I will say that the pitfalls is removing the ILM can be much more tricky off detached retina. Using a staining agent such as indocyanine green may carry, you know, there may be more concern that it may go subretinal and cause toxicity. So this is an argument, at least, if you do a risk-benefit during surgery and you think that the risks of peeling the ILM outweigh the benefits, this is an argument that maybe you don't, just with positioning with a gas bubble, you can get good closure if you repair the detachment. So I found this super fascinating. And this feeds into the other study results presented from the PRO study. So let's first start with the moderately complex phakic detachments. This was Dr. Ed Ryan, who's from the same group up in Minnesota. He talked about outcomes for phakic detachments. And some of this had been presented previously in terms of the anatomic success and had been mentioned here before. But you kind of highlighted when you wrote the summary that breaking down the three different surgeries employed and the different success rates. So you're a second year fellow, you're forming your practice patterns and for when you go out on your own. And how does this influence what you feel about different surgery options for phakic detachments?
That's a great question, Jay. And to be completely honest, I'm somewhat perplexed, and that's why I haven't yet really established my practice pattern. But I think that the findings of the PRO study, to my maybe naive opinion and experience, they're somewhat disruptive. I think that these findings really should get us talking as a field about whether patients should have just a straight vit or a vit buckle or just a buckle for moderately complex phakic detachments. And then we'll talk about the pseudophakic arm of the study. But first, as you mentioned, Dr. Ryan gave a really nice talk summarizing the phakic side of the PRO study, where this was a study that was looking at six different centers of really highly respected retinal surgeons that was retrospectively looking, I think, at the year 2015, all moderately complex phakic detachments. So what are the exclusion criteria? What is a moderately complex detachment? Basically, they tried to weed out or exclude any of these eyes that would really favor one direction or the other. So they removed any patients that were less than 40 years old, because that would obviously favor a buccal, vitreous hemorrhage, which would favor a vitrectomy, an RD that was less than 3 clock hours, which would favor a vitrectomy or a buccal, or an RD over 9 clock hours, which would favor a combined vit buccal, or eyes with grade C PVR, giant retinal tears, significant cataract, or a planned membrane peel. So what's left, right? So basically these are eyes that have more than 3 but less than 9 clock hours without significant PVR, vitreous hemorrhage, giant retinal tear, and that were over age 40. So they found that among 789 eligible eyes, 22%, or maybe 1 out of 5, underwent a primary scleral buccal. 36% underwent a vitrectomy, and 42% underwent a combined vit buccal. And Jay, do you think experience of kind of 1 out of 5 getting a buccal, 35% or so getting a straight vit, and then 42% getting a combined buccal vit?
That seems pretty consistent.
And I think that's one thing we have to ask ourselves. Does this kind of align with what our experience is? And it's big data, right? So it should be pretty consistent. Comical success rate with just one surgery was 91% for those with a buccal, 91% for those with a combined vit buccal, and it dropped to 84% for a straight vitrectomy for repair of this moderate complex phakic detachment. So that's interesting in the sense that it was actually inferior. The outcomes were worse in the vitrectomy alone side of these results compared to those with a buccal or a vit buccal for the RD repair. And I think that's somewhat disruptive. Don't you think that maybe we should be doing more of these as buccals or vit buccals and less as just straight vitrectomies?
This is not the first time. And again, I don't have that many more gray hairs or years of wisdom to comment on the history of this. But just to give you some frame of reference, I don't think this is the first time this has been either shown or talked about in terms of phakic detachments doing worse with a straight vitrectomy in terms of single surgery anatomic success. For example, there was a European study, this was probably 2014, right when I started my fellowship, there's a European study that showed, and their success rate was very low for a straight vitrectomy. You're talking about phakic detachments, I think it was 64% or something in the European study. And, you know, here's all the limitations, right, that people are going to point out in any sort of retinal detachment study. I'll say these at the beginning as a disclaimer. Retrospective data, selection bias of cases, different surgeons, different comfort with procedures. You know, everyone says, well, I do my phakic detachments with a primary vitrectomy and I have no issues. I mean, these, again, everyone is different, and there are people who have reported very high success rates with phakic or pseudophakic detachments with vitrectomy alone. There are people who say they never do buccals or buccal vitrectomies, or they do one or the other. But you're right. I think this data is good in the sense it's a large number of cases from multiple practices. Again, there can be arguments from people who don't do buccals that, well, maybe these people just aren't as comfortable doing straight vitrectomies because they're doing so many buccal vitrectomy procedures that maybe they aren't done in other practices. But I do think that there, and I use this in my own practice pattern, I have a very low threshold in phakic detachments to consider a buccal. And that's my personal preference. And so I had attendings who kind of instilled in me that when I see a phakic detachment, my thoughts are pneumatic, yes or no. And if not a pneumatic candidate, then buccal versus buccal plus or minus vitrectomy. I will do straight vitrectomies, but in general, the ideal candidate for that sort of procedure is not your younger phakic patient. So again, practice patterns change, but you're right. I think that this needs to stimulate conversation about whether or not we should be doing more buccals. And then the elephant in the room is people are doing less and less buccals, which means depending on where you trained, you may not do as many buccal vitrectomies or straight buccals. It means you're less comfortable, which means your success rate may actually be lower with the procedure if you're not doing it as much. The second elephant in the room is that reimbursement rates are different. You know, so buccal vitrectomy and vitrectomy reimburse the same. It's the same code. It's vitrectomy with or without a buccal. It's 67108. And then a straight buccal reimburses slightly less than a vitrectomy. And if you operate at an ASC, either A, you may not have a capable assistant to help you with your buccal, though obviously there's ways to get around that if you're trained to do this alone. And then buckle may take longer, and may take longer, especially if you're in a place where your practice pattern is to use general anesthesia for your buckles, although local anesthesia has been described. So there's multiple things kind of wrapped in this. And I think that the trend is, unfortunately, that regardless of the data, that there is a trend where people are just less comfortable doing buckles or buckle vitrectomies. So the real question is going to be, does this actually influence practice patterns? I think it should, or at least, like you said, it should stimulate conversation. Tell us a little bit about, and you can close up with any final thoughts you have about the faking detachments and lead us into discussion of the pseudo-faking detachments.
No, I think you've covered it. You've covered it really well, Jay. Moving on to the pseudophakic detachments, Daniel Joseph presented the pseudophakic side of the PRO study. And in this side of the study, it did not look at the same moderately complex detachments like the phakic arm did, but they did remove eyes with PVR or less than 90 days follow-up or prior glaucoma surgery. So these are just in a large group of pseudophakic detachments, MAC on, MAC off, and they had 887 eligible eyes for this part of the study. And not surprisingly, the majority, 77%, or about three-fourths of these patients, underwent repair via straight vitrectomy, with the balance being 23% undergoing buccal vitrectomy. And the really surprising thing was that the rate of single surgery anatomic success was different between these two groups. And among the MAC on RDs, the success rate was 87.8% of those treated with just a vitrectomy, compared to 97.5% treated with a combined buccal vitrectomy. And then among those eyes with a MAC off RD, the success rate was 80.7% with the straight vitrectomy, compared to 89% of those treated with a buccal vitrectomy. So 3 out of 4 of our pseudophakic RDs without PVR or prior glaucoma surgery are undergoing straight vitrectomy, but the actual increase in success rate is 10% roughly if that patient gets a buccal vitrectomy instead of just a straight vitrectomy. So what do you think, Jay? Did this surprise you, or do you think this will get us talking, or how should we take this knowledge and apply it to our clinical practice?
So the first place I saw this was actually, I believe you posted images on Twitter, or maybe this is, I don't remember if it's this talk that they took. You put some images up of some of the slides, and then you posted this article, and I read this, and I read kind of your analysis, and I loved it, because I said, it wouldn't be what I expect, right? I would say, if anything, you would think the buccal vitrectomy group, just by selection bias, may have an artificially lowered success rate, because you may be choosing to employ a buccal vitrectomy in cases that are more complicated, that you're more concerned about recurrent detachment. And sometimes that selection bias from the start can make your outcome be lowered artificially, where you're cherry picking the worst cases that got buccal vitrectomy. And this is not the case. If anything, like you said, 10% higher success rate with a combined buccal vitrectomy. Obviously, the buccal does reduce traction along the vitreous base. The buccal does, offer support 360 degrees that is more permanent. So I do think 10% is a pretty shocking difference. I would be curious, and you didn't show the data here, and maybe they didn't show it, if there was an age difference in the patients who got the buccal vitrectomy versus vitrectomy, because this is something that's referenced here before, but I do think that we have younger and younger patients who are pseudophakic now, as patients get cataract surgery younger and younger. And I do think, especially high myopes can get this cataract surgery done earlier because for refractive reasons. And not every pseudophakic detachment is built the same. A young pseudophakic previous myope in their 40s who has a detachment is different in my mind than a 70-year-old, 75-year-old pseudophakic detachment who was emmetropic before their cataract surgery. And I think we're seeing more and more of these younger, quote-unquote, previous myope, they are still myopes in terms of their anatomy, detachments. And I wonder if, again, the success rate difference is driven by that group. And we won't know until we see the age breakdown here. But again, I do think that maybe we will see this difference in buccal vitrectomies being more successful as percentage of the patients are coming from the the younger age cohort than from the older kid age cohort.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Jay. And I think that a key takeaway for all of us from this needs to be that because this is a little bit surprising, that we need to drill down into this data even more to better understand it. Because like you're saying, maybe once we stratify by age, we'll find where that real difference is. And then maybe if there is a big difference in age or some other risk factor or characteristic, we can really better hone our surgical planning to target that kind of at-risk demographic to optimize their single surgery success rate. So I think this is enough for us to say, well, let's be aware of this and let's start thinking about this and let's try and figure out who's going to have the best outcome with what type of surgery.
Yeah, those are great points. And Steve, again, thanks so much for summarizing. And you and others who do this, again, this is a little bit of a game changer in terms of giving us access to information we didn't previously have. So kudos to you for putting the time in to put this together. And very, very good summary. Again, if you people want to find it, it kind of goes through some of the major talks at the meeting and is not only kind of breaking down the results, but gives you a little bit of an analysis of what this may mean. So kudos to you. You know, another thing you guys, you know, I haven't talked to you since you guys published this. We mentioned this in one of our journal clubs about residency and fellowships, but you guys did publish your paper on the vitreoretinal surgical fellowship application process and experience. We won't rehash the results here, but you had mentioned to me that there was a lot of correspondence about that. It was a very hot topic. What's kind of the biggest feedback you've gotten about that study since you published it?
I think it just helps everyone be aware of some of the characteristics of the vitreoretinal surgery fellowship match, and as well as be aware of how communication with programs after the match can potentially change people's decision-making patterns as far as where they rank each other on their rank list. And that if you do kind of disclose your number one, that maybe that could change how the other party ranks you. And that could have a long-term effect. So, you know, anytime that there's discussion on something like this, I just think it's exciting. I think it's good for us all to just be talking and being aware of these type things. It was kind of exciting on my end to hear that someone had written a letter to the editor about our paper. And so I encourage everyone to check out next month. I think it's about the middle of October. There'll be a letter to the editor in JAMA Ophthalmology with our reply to that letter. So I think letters to the editor are always so exciting to get some editorial kind of commentary on people's opinions about these papers. And so I just encourage everyone to take a look. I think, you know, there have been some changes in other fields, such as plastic surgery residency prohibits any communication at all between applicants and programs. And so there's some suggestion from one of these, this letter, that we should be like, maybe we should adopt that strategy as a specialty and not allow any communication whatsoever between applicants and programs. So just a little bit of a teaser that my response is in that in the middle of October issue of JAMA Ophthalmology, but it's exciting. I think it's an exciting time to be in our field, and there's lots of discussion about how we should proceed moving forward.
That's such an interesting argument about making it no communication either way, but I think that, you know, you're a Utah Jazz fan, you follow the NBA, I follow the NBA. I mean, this is like when the NBA puts a moratorium and says, you know, teams and agents and players can't talk until July 1st, and all that happens is there's just under the table conversation, encourages under the table conversation. It's going to happen regardless, where players talk to players at a party or socially, or you text message them, and it's not technically a violation. It doesn't necessarily create a more even playing field. I would almost argue, I don't know, I think it's difficult because there's huge influence, like you said, on communication on both the applicant experience and how they're ranked by programs. But if that's happening regardless, maybe you just get rid of kind of the facade that we're not communicating and just make it an open playing field. The only thing you could argue is it may be overwhelming for the applicant, you know, to be inundated with pressure from programs. And maybe that's really the goal, is to protect the applicant. But I just wonder, again, I feel like this is communication is such a hard thing to regulate. It's really an honor system more than anything. So, but it's an interesting point and argument. So, you know, Steve, last thing before we go, you and I, shameless plug, I've given a couple times on the podcast, you and I, amongst our colleagues, we're giving this course on online content, social media. Academy, October 29th, Monday, 4:30 p.m., N136. As you can tell, I've said that before as a spiel. I have not seen your slides yet. We've broken up into kind of sections, but if you had a buddy who was going to think about coming to the course and you had to give him a 30-second highlight of the sort of things you're going to talk about, give him a little preview.
Thanks, Jay. Well, you're really the leader in so many ways of this course and with the podcast and everything. And I think you're a great example of this. I think what I would tell my buddy is that the era of us all learning about our field from throwaway journals is really, it's an era that needs to change and that can change, where we as physicians, as retina specialists, can be educating each other about our own field and creating content online through blogs and social media and podcasts and YouTube channels. It can be a powerful tool that we can connect with each other, that we can educate our colleagues and also educate the public. So this is a course that it's just a brief 1-hour course. We have several colleagues that are going to be joining us to talk about how they're using online social media and content creation to build their practice and connect with patients and educate their colleagues. And so we hope to kind of just go through some of the basics of online content creation, talk about educating patients and physicians, talk about some of the privacy concerns, and answer anyone's questions that may be present that's considering about dabbling or getting started in this area.
Perfect. Steve Christensen, his website can be found at iSteve.com. That's EYESteve.com. Steve, great talking to you. I'm looking forward to seeing you at Academy, and hopefully we'll see a lot of the listeners out there too.
Thanks, Jay. Always a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Hey, have a great day. Take care.
Thanks.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. All 130 episodes, yes, 130 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. We just put a new post in our blog. This will be up on the website as well, and this is kind of our best of the best. Our team picked out some episodes that we felt were most representative of the podcast and probably good, even if you've listened to them before. I love re-listening to some of these, so you can re-listen to the episodes there. At the bottom of the website are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love feedback, both things we can do better, things we're already doing well, and episode ideas. And anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play, we love positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Steve Christensen for joining me. Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Vinicasa, and Angela Chang produced this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.